Welcome everyone to the beginning of our 5-week introductory course in mindfulness. And since people are still coming in a little bit, I thought I would start by telling you two stories. The first story is about a bureaucrat back about 200 years ago, maybe longer, in Japan, who went to visit a Zen master. And one of the things that traditionally Zen masters are supposed to do, kind of in the job description, is to do calligraphy. And great Zen masters were praised for their great calligraphy. And so this bureaucrat went to the Zen master, a famous Zen master, and he asked him if he would write the kernel, the essence of Buddhism, on a scroll of paper with his beautiful calligraphy. And so the Zen master kind of nodded with great eagerness and said, yeah, I'll be happy to do that. And so he took out his brush and he prepared, and with great precision and attention to detail, real presence to what he was doing, he wrote out the character, attention. And he handed the paper to the bureaucrat. And the bureaucrat said, you misunderstood. What I wanted was kind of the really core, essential teachings of Buddhism, something really profound, the profound teachings of Buddhism. And the Zen master said, I see. And so then he took another piece of paper and he wrote, attention, attention. And the bureaucrat said, but you don't seem to understand. What I want is the profundity of Buddhism. This Buddhism is this famous, world religion and philosophy and way of life. And it's gone through India to China to Japan and all over the world. And it's one of the great religions of the world. I want something that represents something that profundity, something great teaching. Zen master said again, I see what you want. And so he wrote the third piece of paper. He wrote, attention, attention, attention. So attention is important. And then the second story is, I was reminded of it today. When I was practicing in a monastery in Japan, there was an older monk who'd been in the monastery a few years longer. And I asked him why he ended up in the monastery, why he was there. And he told a story that before he was a monk, he had spent 7 years as an apprentice to a master farmer, organic farmer in Japan, who, in Japan they have these national living treasures, the potters and the painters and people who do great art, great crafts. And he was a kind of a master farmer, was his craft, and was known for that, and people would come and apprentice with him. And it was a beautiful place in rural Japan with mountains and forest all the way around the farm, and it was really nice. And he lived there for 7 years studying with this great master. And then one day he walked up to his master and he explained to him, I've been here for 7 years and I still don't know that the trees are green. I'm going to a Zen monastery. And meaning that, as I understood it, they had been in this beautiful setting for 7 years, and his mind hadn't been awake enough, paid attention enough, been present enough for him to notice something that's totally obvious to all of us, and that is that the trees are green. And of course he knew the trees were green, but he really felt that he was really missing something about the alive connection we can have with life when we bring our full presence to it. And that's a simple thing to say, but remember the Zen master wrote attention, and that's pretty simple too. And there's something very simple about what Buddhism teaches when it teaches meditation. It teaches us something which is in some sense child's play. Pay attention. My mother used to tell me all the time, she's not a Zen master, in the usual sense of the word. She'd pay attention, Gil. Or she would tell me, enjoy your food while you're eating it. simple things, that Zen masters will tell their students. So it's simple things we're talking about when we talk about Buddhist meditation practice. And I think if we reflect a little bit, or if we do pay a little bit of attention to our life, many of us will find that we spend an inordinate amount of time lost in our preoccupations. The preoccupations, it means all kinds of things. Worrying about the future, remembering the past, regretting the past, reliving the past, concerned, lost in fantasy, lost in ambition, and lost in our busyness. One of the great violence of our culture currently, especially in this part of the country, the violence that we submit ourselves to is the violence of being overly busy and then running around kind of constantly kind of doing 10 things at once. I've heard that there are people who, while they're driving, have been seen talking on the cell phone and shaving. You know, trying to do too many things at once is dangerous for your health. So when we were lost in our preoccupation, we can take care of some, you can kind of often take care of things in a kind of rudimentary way, but feeling any kind of deep connection with ourselves and deep connection to life isn't really possible when we spend too much of our time preoccupied or too much of our time numbed out or distracted. And our culture is also one of focuses a lot on distraction. Much of our commercial culture wants us to be consumers, and being consumers is to be distracted often enough. And certainly the attempts to get us to be consumers, they're trying to distract our attention from anything else. And so there's kind of constant barrage of efforts to keep us preoccupied, and so that we don't enjoy the childlike kind of possibility we have, all of us, of being nothing special, just being awake and noticing that the trees are green and the asphalt is black some places. So mindfulness practice is what we're going to talk about these 5 weeks, is a practice of strengthening this natural ability that we all have to pay attention, to be mindful, to be attentive, to be alert. And there's nothing particularly Buddhist about it. There's nothing particularly religious about it. If you care, there's nothing particularly spiritual about attention. It's something that the most unspiritual in the world, most unspiritual person in the world has attention, has the ability to pay attention. And what we're talking about is strengthening that ability, making it more something that's more present in our life, so that it becomes a home for us, a place where we abide, rather than the place we might visit occasionally when reality forces itself onto us in our preoccupations. And our life goes a lot smoother when we bring more attention to it. Attention or awareness or mindfulness is a tremendous salve, a tremendous lubricant for our life. It's a tremendous source for feeling a lot of the things in life that we feel are the most beautiful, the most precious things of life. I don't know what each of you think of as the most precious part of life, your experience of being alive, or the thing you treasure the most. But I would venture to guess that for most of you, that whatever that you treasure most about being alive, that you can only really experience that if you're really in the present moment. If it's friendship, you know, to really experience friendship directly, you have to really be there for the friend. Joy, delight, beauty, you know, these are things that happen when we're present in the present moment. If you're thinking about yesterday and yesterday's friendships and yesterday's beauty, I don't think it has the same alive feeling of connectedness to life and to that precious treasure of what's possible as it is to feel those things in the present moment. And to the degree to which we can open and learn the tools or the strength or the ability to really learn how to be present more and more often, our life and the treasures of life will kind of open up to us more and more often. People come to a mindfulness class like this for many reasons. Probably each of you has your own reason to come. Many people come because they're stressed out, and there's a lot of stress with this kind of life many of us live, and so there's a feeling of needing some balance, some way to calm down or de-stress or relax a little bit. And mindfulness meditation now has a reputation in America as being a kind of form of stress reduction. Some people feel disconnected with themselves, and mindfulness is a way of finding a connectedness again with oneself. And enough people are strangers to themselves, and often when we're strangers to ourselves, to open up and to become alive to ourselves again is often to open up to also to pain within ourselves. And so feeling a connectedness to ourselves is to go through a period of feeling old pains and griefs and sadnesses sometimes. Some people come here because they've had some experience in their life of great peace or great openness or great joy, or And they feel that something, you know, they feel they want to find some way to touch into that kind of sense of presence again, well-being again. And maybe they think this kind of practice might help them. There's many reasons why a person does this kind of practice. And you're all welcome to come here for whatever reason you want. It's not my job to tell you why you should be here, exactly. I'll try to tell you a little bit about some generic reasons why mindfulness is a good idea. But it's really up to you. And I think this is a very important part of the teachings of Buddhism itself, is that you're really here for yourself, and you use whatever I teach you, the practices that I teach you, really to help you live the life of that you want to live, that you want to kind of wake up to, and the one that you feel will bring you the deepest forms of joy and happiness and compassion for your life and for the life around you. So my name is Gil Fronsdal, and I've been teaching here in Palo Alto since 1990. And I've been practicing Buddhism for a long time. For about 25 years now. And I first did many years of Zen practice, and was ordained as a Zen priest and went to Japan and practiced there. And then I went to Southeast Asia, to Thailand and Burma, where I was introduced to this practice that I'm teaching you here, what's called Vipassana in the Buddhist language. And Vipassana is just a foreign language way of saying clear seeing, looking deeply. The usual way to translate it into English is insight meditation, because it's kind of literal with the word sight. Passana means to see. Though more generically, we often just call it mindfulness practice. So I learned that in Thailand and Burma. And then I came back and continued my practice here. And then in the late 80s, I started training with Jack Kornfield to be a mindfulness Vipassana teacher, and started teaching in Palo Alto. And I teach here, and I teach at Spirit Rock, which is a meditation center we're building in Marin County and around different places. And I'm just finished up a doctorate in, of all things, Buddhist studies at Stanford. And no one?
Sandbagging.
And one of the great advantages of having gone through a doctoral program in Buddhist studies is I can say now with great authority that you don't need to get a doctorate in Buddhist studies to understand Buddhism. But what?
I think that's generally true.
And so, all you need to do to learn about Buddhism is study yourself. And whatever you need to know about Buddhism, you'll discover on your own, through your own ability to observe yourself and life around you. So a lot of what we'll talk about in these 5 weeks, hopefully, are kind of tools or angles or perspectives or pointers to how to, for you to bring more attention to all kinds of different parts of your life. Today we'll talk about the basic meditation practice of bringing attention to the breath. And the breath is kind of a central part of a life of mindfulness. The breath is this marvelous place that bridges the conscious and unconscious mind. Some people would say the mundane world and the spiritual world, and whatever. It's a great bridge. It's a great place, the breath. It's a great kind of focal point or pivot point for much of our life. And the breath is one of the most phenomenal things you can study in your life, because it opens up in all directions to everything else in their life. And so practice often starts with a very simple thing, a mindfulness of breathing. But then we don't stop there, but rather this practice is learning then to expand the attention beyond the breath to other aspects of our life. And so next week I'll talk about how to include our physical life, our body, being embodied in the practice of mindfulness. And then the third week I'll talk about our emotional life, how to include our emotions as part of meditation, as part of mindfulness practice. And the fourth week, I'll talk about thoughts and how to include the world of our thinking, our mental life. And then the final week will be more about how to include the mindfulness in all aspects of our daily life, our daily activities. And what you'll hear, as you listen to me, is a ambiguity in how I teach, in that I don't make a very clear distinction between mindfulness as something you do in meditation practice, and mindfulness is something you do in your daily life, something you do just you're cooking or driving your car or whatever. Mindfulness can be brought to everything you do. And so I warn you now that I kind of slide back and forth, and sometimes you might think I'm talking about meditation, and then suddenly I'm talking about, you know, something that's more applicable to your daily life. I don't see a sharp line at all between meditation and daily life. They're just continuous with each other. And to feel that there's a sharp divide between the world of meditation and the world of everyday life is a tremendous delusion, which in the long term will cause a lot of suffering in your life if you continue with meditation. If you don't continue with meditation, you don't have to worry about it. So we have these 5 weeks. These talks are taped, and previous of these 5 week introductory courses have been taped. If for some reason you miss a class and would like to get a copy of it on tape or whatever, Allison's here, can sell you copies of the tape if you miss a week or whatever. And Allison also sells meditation paraphernalia. Like these round zafus that I sit on, which are great for sitting in meditation, or these crescent moons, which some people like to sit on, and benches. I'll talk about them in a minute, but Allison is a great resource. There's other places to get these things around, like in East West Books, but Allison, I believe, is cheaper. So logistic-wise, what else to say, kind of as an introduction? The way that we teach in the tradition that I teach in, this tradition of Vipassana, is that the teachers are dedicated to offering the teachings as freely as possible. Actually, the teachers want to teach freely, meaning that just to make it available to people for no cost at all, no charge. And part of the reason for that is that we think that the teachings are priceless. And part of why I love doing what I do, this kind of teaching, is that I'm teaching what I love. Because I think mindfulness, the simple thing, you know, that my mother used to tell me to do, I think is actually really precious and lovely, and something I'm deeply in love with, and have a chance to share something I love so deeply with, and maybe even kind of somehow convey that love I have for being alert and attentive and present, is a great source of satisfaction for me. So that's one reason. The other reason, so that's, you know, one reason is priceless, and the other reason is we don't want to make money a barrier, so people who don't feel like they have the means or whatever won't come. So you're welcome. Anybody's welcome to come and participate in any way you want. It's relatively informal this way. We do have two baskets out in the hallway, and the way that the teachers then are supported, because we don't charge anything, the teachers are supported by donations, by those people who are inspired to support the teachers. Like me, 99% of my support comes from people who make donations to allow me to teach. And this is how I support myself. It's my livelihood. And so what it means is that it isn't that I'm looking for to make money, but this being supported by donations allows me then to continue doing this kind of activity. And I can't continue doing this kind of activity, the degree in which I do it, unless I get support. So this is the way we teach in this tradition. And so there's two baskets out there. One basket is donation if you want to help us pay for the rent, because we have to we pay the Quakers rent for this building. And if everybody paid a dollar for rent, that would more than cover it. And the other basket is, I think it says teacher dana. Dana means generosity. And that's for whatever you want to donate for me, for the teaching. And I'll say, I guess what I often say, there's a funny attitude that we have in America about money. Kind of, we have a lot of confusion about money. And one of the odd things is that it seems that people value what they pay for more than what's offered kind of in this kind of donated system. If I had charged, you know, a phenomenal amount of money for a 5 week introductory course, maybe fewer of you would have come. But then you would have come every week. There was a friend of mine in Australia who was teaching this way, and he wasn't making, his life wasn't working. He couldn't make it work, so he said, forget this, I'm going to charge. So I think he charged something equivalent of $60 for a six-week class. And not only were all his classes filled, but he had to do many more classes a week. He was phenomenally popular. So just you might think about that when you... So that's what we'll do. So today I'm going to talk about meditation. And meditation is a beautiful thing to do. Meditation creates a lot of... can create a lot of calm and a lot of presence in your life. But more importantly, and the purpose of mindfulness meditation is not necessarily to create calm and presence in your life, but rather to help you be more attentive to what your life actually is. And that's really the definition of mindfulness, is attentiveness to what your life really is right now. And to be deeply attentive to what this life is right now. And the more attentive that we get, the more we realize that our life is a lot different than what we thought it was. And that's part of the great delight of a life of mindfulness and meditation, is increasing depths of understanding of ourselves and the world around us open up as we become more and more attentive. It can be a great source of surprise that we discover the world is a different place than what we thought. There's two ways of creating change in our life, maybe many ways, but I just mentioned two. One is by force, and the other is by allowing. And the way of force is one that many of us are all too familiar with. We go out and do things, and you know, do things kind of actively and forcefully with ambition or with decisiveness or whatever. Meditation doesn't work very well. Mindfulness doesn't work very well if you're trying to create deep change, spiritual change, from force. Meditation works much more through allowing. And it's very hard for people who are used to controlling things and being in control, because meditation doesn't work by you being in control and thinking you can control everything. It can be very, very frightening, meditation, for people who are really control addicts, because meditation won't succeed if you're trying to control it. But if you give up control, that's scary. So for some people, it's very, very challenging. So meditation unfolds most out of a sense of allowing things to unfold. And if you allow things to unfold, part of the reason it can be scary is you have no idea how it's going to unfold. No idea. And I'm not going to know how it's going to unfold for you. I would love to sit here and promise and give a guarantee that you'll feel all this wonderful joy and delight and bliss and dissolve in white light and all when you meditate. I don't have a clue what's going to happen. Some of you are going to have phenomenally painful knees. And it might be better meditation to sit there with your painful knees than to dissolve in white light. I'm serious. And, you know, I'm really serious about that. Or you might feel tremendous grief upwelling, you know, that you never felt, never allowed yourself to feel. And you say, wait a minute, I thought I was supposed to be feeling calm. Meditation is about allowing ourselves to be as we are, and allowing, just appreciating or attending or being attentive to what surfaces as we allow things to be. So let me teach you a little bit about meditation posture, because I think it's very important to have a stable posture to do a meditation practice. Part of the function of a stable posture is to take a posture that allows you to sit upright in a self-reliant kind of way for long enough to kind of do a period of meditation. Part of the path of mindfulness is a path of becoming increasingly self-reliant. And there's a wonderful correlation between our inner psychological life and our physical body. And if we use a backrest to meditate, you're not physically being self-reliant. And it's actually harder, a little bit harder, to become psychologically self-reliant if you're using a backrest. Now, it's possible to do meditation in any posture at all. So, and there's all kinds of bodies. And you have the body you have, and it's everything, every body is a perfectly good body for the purposes of mindfulness and waking up. So if you need to use a backrest, that's fine. But if you don't have to use it, then I encourage you not to use it. So in order to help us kind of sit up straight and let our spine be self-supporting, I'll first talk about how to sit on the floor. I found it's best to... the most stable floor posture is a tripod, three points. And you make a nice tripod by sitting cross-legged. It's part of the reason for sitting cross-legged. It's very stable. To have your two knees touching the floor, and then your tailbone or your butt on a cushion, so you're raised up a little bit. I like to sit in the Burmese fashion, with one leg is straight in front of the other, kind of like this, if you can see my arms at least. So that both kind of lower legs are flat on the floor. It's possible to cross your legs, so one is on top of the other, but it's less symmetrical that way, and it tends to kind of, if you sit like in half lotus with one foot up on the other thigh, it tends to lean us a little bit to one side. And I'm exaggerating a little bit now, but, and then if you straighten yourself out, you stretch one part of your body more than the other. And in the long term, that's something that yoga teachers don't like about meditators. And because they're stretching one side more than the other. And a good yoga teacher, a good meditation teacher will say, if you sit that kind of way with one leg up, then you should alternate legs so you stretch both sides of your body. But the Burmese fashion is more or less symmetrical, and it's a very stable, nice way. It's easier to sit than cross-legged. That's one way of sitting. And then you want to sit up on a cushion. And again, these round cushions are called zafus, are very useful to sit on. And the idea with these is not to sit flat down on the top, but rather to sit on the front third of them. Because you're kind of sitting on the slant, on the slope, and that sitting higher and sitting on the slope lets your pelvis tilt forward slightly. And if your pelvis tilted forward slightly, it's easier to get your knees down. And also, it then creates a little bit of a strength in the curve in your lower back. You want to have a little bit of curve in your lower back. A little bit more maybe than what you normally have. Just ever so slightly more. And that little curve in your lower back will make it a lot easier to have your rest of your spine straight and upright. If you collapse in your lower back, then you put a lot of strain in your muscles and you get tired really quickly. And depending on how open you are on your hips, to get your knees down, you need to sit higher. So the more open you are, the lower you sit, the less open you are on your hips, the higher you sit. So you have to kind of experiment with your cushions. Everybody can get their knees down if they sit high enough. But then there's a trade-off between getting your knees down and having your meditation cushion be a slide. And you slide right off. So you have to kind of, you know... if you can't get both knees down, one possibility is to get some other cushions and prop up your knees so that your knees are a little bit supported so they're not stretching too much and hurting. Another way of sitting is to sit on your knees, which is easier for some people. And you can take the round zafu and put it upright between your ankles and then sit straight down on top of it, like this. Or you can sit in the bench, which is also nice. And these benches you put over your ankles and then sit down on it, like this. Both are nice. And it's not as stable as a tripod, but it's pretty good this way. And some of you might not be used to sitting cross-legged, might want to alternate. Rather than always being in one posture. Now, if you're sitting on a chair, you want to be stable on the chair. And so if you can avoid using the backrest, you just kind of sit a little bit further out from on the chair. And you want to have both feet, not crossed now, but actually, usually it's said to have both feet parallel to each other, but some people like to have them out slightly, but parallel to each other with both feet flat on the ground. And with the knees lower than your hips. If your knees are higher than your hips, then there's a tendency where the lower back caves out and it becomes bad for your posture. In the long term, you'll have back problems. But if your hips are higher than your knees, that creates a little bit of a curve in your lower back, easier, and it's much healthier for your spine. And all this is to help you sit with a strong, upright spine. And one way to help also is to take both hands on either side of your hips, on the chair, on the floor, and lift yourself almost off your cushion or your chair, letting your chest come up. And then as you release your arms, if you can, let your shoulders kind of roll back, your back, down the back. And that kind of gives you a sense of being upright and straight. Then it's nice to create a little bit of space in the back of your neck where the last vertebrae meets your skull. Just create a little bit of space, and that tends to bring your head down, tilt your head down slightly. And when we sit and meditate, we sit with the eyes gently closed and the tongue up against the roof, resting against the roof of the mouth. The mouth is closed. And the hands can be in any posture that's more or less symmetrical. The classic Buddhist posture for the hands is to have the hands together in front of you. If you have them in front of you, and if you have them resting on your, and you're sitting on the floor, and you have them resting on the heel or the ankle, depending on the proportions of your body, you might find that you're pulling your shoulders down and putting a strain in your upper shoulders. And then if that's the case, you might get a little pillow or a cushion or something and put it on top of your heel so you can rest your hands higher. Some people like to have them on their hands, on their thighs, on their knees, facing up or facing down. So it's up to you, whatever feels comfortable. And that's kind of the rudimentaries about posture. Do you have any questions about that? About posture, about the posture you're sitting in, or... Okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
Does it matter which leg is in front of the other?
No. I mean, again, if I was really doing a good job, I would say that you should alternate to really make sure you have the right, you know, not getting lopsided. But it doesn't matter. As far as I know, it doesn't matter. Different people have different leggedness. Well, should we try it then? So why don't you take the posture? Mm-hmm. And to simplify the posture instruction, you want to sit in the way where you're sitting alert, but relaxed. It's in a comfortable but alert way with your body. So your spine is alert. And around that alert spine, energized spine, you let your shoulders, your body, your stomach relax. I find that it's often useful at the beginning of a session of meditation to take two or three deep breaths. And then as you breathe out, maybe breathing out a little bit longer than usual, relaxing your body, letting go into your seat, into your body. So you might take a couple of three deep breaths. And then let your breath become normal, letting your breath breathe itself. In mindfulness meditation, there is no right or wrong way of breathing. You can breathe whatever way you happen to be breathing at this moment, or any moment. Sometimes in New Age California, there's an idea that to be spiritual or cool or hip or whatever, you need to have a long, deep breath. In this mindfulness meditation circle, we are free from having that kind of idea. You can just breathe whatever way you're breathing. As you're breathing, as feel your body, sense where in your body the body's experience of breathing is most predominant. clearest? Do you experience your breathing most in your abdomen rising and falling, or your chest rising and falling, or the sensation of the air passing through your nostrils? Where is it the clearest for you? And wherever you found is the more or less the clearest or the easiest place to notice it, become aware of what the body's experience is of breathing. The expansion and contraction, the movement, the tingling. Letting go of your thoughts and concerns. Allow yourself to sense, to feel, to experience how it is the body feels your breathing. Feeling the full cycle of inhalation and the exhalation. Feeling how each of them is different from each other. And what will inevitably happen is your mind will wander off into thoughts and lose the connection with the breath. And when you notice that this has happened, then very softly reestablish that connection with the conscious breathing, feeling your breath consciously, allowing yourself to be as simple as you can, to experience simply this particular in-breath, this very out-breath, It doesn't matter how many times your mind wanders away. It only matters that whenever you notice it's done so, that you bring yourself back to the breathing. And for every moment that you're connected to your breathing, consciously breathing, you're softening the force of your preoccupation with thoughts and concerns, past and the future. Each moment of being with the breath is a step towards increased freedom of presence. And the spirit of meditation is that of allowing. It's okay to be whatever way you are right now. Just in the midst of that, to be devoted to your breath, to breathing in and out. Letting go of your thoughts. Breathing consciously. Breathing awarely. The exhalation is a kind of letting go, especially near the end of it. Be attentive to the very end of the letting go, the end of the exhalation. And then allow the inhalation to come into awareness by itself. If anything happens while you're sitting, with your physical body or your emotional being, that makes it difficult to pay attention to the breath, continue with the breath. And we'll continue for one more minute. And with great tenderness and gentleness, try to stay as alert as you can with the breath for 1 minute. So there's an infinite range of possibilities of what might happen to you as you attempt to be mindful of your breathing. But I want to mention two general, fairly common possibilities. One is that doing something so simple as just being with your breathing, to the rhythmic oscillations of contracting and expanding as you breathe or whatever, the movement, the sensations, is that it can create some calmness. We can get calmer. Breathing consciously tends to make many people a little bit calmer than they usually are, partly because we're not so preoccupied then with all our concerns and running around in our mind, whatever. And becoming calm, a little bit calm, is a great way of developing clearer ability to see. And part of the function of developing calmness in Buddhism is so not so we can just be calm, not for its own sake, but rather so we can be more attentive and see more clearly what's going on in the present moment. The other possibility that could be happening as you follow the breath is you become very clearly aware of how difficult it is, how often your mind wanders off into thought or preoccupations or whatever. One thing that might happen when you notice this is you might feel discouraged or upset or critical, or here I'm doing one more thing that I can't do. There's many reactions you could have that cause a lot of suffering if you get caught up in them. Part of the point of mindfulness of the breathing is not to be successful with the mindfulness of the breath, to always kind of stay perfectly on top of the breath, but rather to notice the momentum of your mind, the momentum of your life that's happening that makes it difficult for you to be present for the breath. Often when we're caught up in the momentum of our life, we don't notice it, we don't realize it. If you spend the whole day running around crazy in Palo Alto doing all the 10,000 things, and you sit to meditate at the end of the day, or just sit down to kind of relax at the end of the day, you'll feel your body, the tension in your body, the momentum, the energy, the energized state, whatever, the tiredness, that represents the momentum of all the ways in which we've been preoccupied for the whole day. We carry this with us, a certain amount of momentum. To do something simple as trying to be with our breath, and we notice the momentum keeps taking us away. And as we notice that, we can notice that momentum much more clearly than if we just continued what we were doing, or if we just watched television and fell asleep. So part of the function, paradoxically, of mindfulness of the breathing is to be unsuccessful doing it. Isn't that great? Now, the more successful you are with it, the tendency, the calmer you get. But the point is not necessarily to be successful. The point is to start paying more attention, to wake up to the momentum of your life as it really is. Oh, I'm constantly worrying. Oh, I'm really anxious about this. Oh, I'm still rehearsing the conversations from earlier today because I'm angry. Oh, I didn't know that. So just to notice, oh, this is what's happening for me right now. And remember, it's always the spirit is allowing. So mindfulness meditation is tremendously forgiving because you're allowed to be exactly who you are at that particular moment. You don't have to be anybody different. Isn't that great? You might have thoughts that you're supposed to be different than who you are. And those kinds of thoughts, more often than not, create suffering. And that's why it's, why we encourage you not to do it. But it's one thing to encourage you, and another thing to do it. But it's very nice, I think, to have discovered a practice where you don't have, where you're allowed to be just any old way you happen to be at any one moment. If you have a headache, it's fine to have a headache. You don't have to try to change it. You don't have to try to change anything, but we want to become mindful of what that is and wake up to it. So we try our best to be with the breath, and then we notice what about our present life that takes us away from it. And then once you notice, you come back to the breath and rest there again. Is that clear? Maybe. So what was your experience sitting for 15 minutes? Yes.
I started to fall asleep.
So falling asleep is can be quite common. There's many reasons for falling asleep in meditation. One is we're tired, and if we don't if we don't continuously being involved in activity, either physical activity or mental activity. That tiredness has a chance to surface, and people start falling asleep. We're a caffeinated culture, and the source of the caffeine isn't necessarily coffee, but sometimes it's our mental addictions, our desires and wants and aversions and criticisms and judgments and all these things that keep us kind of alert and going. As those start relaxing, if we're deeply tired, the tiredness reveals itself, and you might just go take a nap. But there are other reasons for falling asleep, especially at the end of the day, especially people are often tired. So it's just, and so the wonderful thing about meditation is that it's often considered, you're not supposed to fall asleep in a sense, but if you fall asleep, that's fine. Good for you. We want you to rest. But the other thing about, but there are other reasons for falling asleep, and one of the other interesting reasons can be sleep is often a protective mechanism that protects us from dealing with something that's difficult or painful. And when we sit and are quiet and let our usual preoccupations kind of settle away, things that kind of distract ourselves from our distractions, distract ourselves from ourselves, then some of the difficult things that we've been distracting ourselves from begin to surface. Sometimes we don't really want to look at them. And so there's an inner kind of wisdom or inner kind of movement in the body that has us just fall asleep. And I see I have a newborn baby at home, and I see that babies have this ability. Maybe that's why we have it. It's left over from when we were babies. You know, if the baby gets overstimulated, too much going on around it, he falls asleep. And it's probably a wonderful ability, adaptive ability for babies. And probably it continues into our adulthood around, you know, sometimes when we have very strong stuff arising. So there's other reasons also for falling asleep. But mostly it's because we're tired. Yes?
My mind just would not shut up. And one of the things that I noticed is that if I got in, was really paying attention to my breath, then my mind is going in, out. I mean, it's starting to label everything. It's very
oh, good. Actually, that's one of the things I should have said, is it's very helpful to label the breath. As you're following the breath, if you with a very soft whisper in the mind, just name in, out, or rising, falling, It's kind of using a thought to nudge you to stay present rather than let your idle thoughts take you away. And it can be very helpful. Some people find it very, very helpful to very softly. The trick is to do it as softly as you can with this inner voice. In, out. So you discover it on your own. Now sometimes when people discover it on their own, there has sometimes a compulsive feeling to it. And then you need to relax that compulsiveness and just let it be kind of soft and gentle. Now one of the first great insights that happens when people meditate is that their mind is out of control. So congratulations. Rather than being discouraged, you should take it as an encouragement. You've reached the first stage. And it's better to know that your mind is out of control than it is not to know it and let it keep doing whatever it wants. And with time, your mind will settle down. As you continue coming back to your breath and coming back to your breath, and you won't be able to stay very long just coming back, with time you'll start both letting go and relaxing. And with time also you start seeing the underlying forces that keep you kind of propelled in your preoccupation. And those will often also soften as you see them deeply. Don't get discouraged. Yes? When you're sleepy, one of the tricks with sleepiness is to open your eyes. And so if you find yourself really sleepy and falling over, you might just open your eyes. And usually the way is to have your eyes down 45 degrees down to the floor, just open, and that can create some alertness. Dreaminess often happens also, because as we get more relaxed, or sometimes we get more sleepy, we kind of enter into this dreamlike state. It often happens just before falling asleep. And you can take it as a good sign if you'd like. Don't worry about it. But your job is to try to strengthen your ability to stay attentive rather than being pulled into the dreams. Yes?
I feel a lot of eye movement.
Yes.
I feel some pressure here trying
yes.
to maintain my eyes closed.
Uh-huh. Well, you're welcome to open your eyes. Just keep them open softly. But again, there's a lot of momentum of our normal ways of living in the world that reveal themselves when we sit. And one of the places where people have a lot of tension is around their eyes and their forehead. And sometimes when we close our eyes, that tension will begin working itself out. And there can be a lot of fluttering. And it'll pass with time. Just allow it to be there. Don't worry about it. Yes? Yes, and you're sitting flat on the floor? Yeah, probably. I can look at your posture later. I don't know, you have back problems normally? No. So I can look at your posture and maybe there's a simple way of kind of straightening out that might help. Some people, there's many reasons for back pain and when you do meditation. A pretty common one for beginners is that most people don't have good postural habits. And if you sit up more or less, some people don't sit up very straight normally in their life, but they're kind of hunched over a computer or whatever. And so to sit up straight requires using different muscles than you're used to. And those muscles get tired and they hurt. So there's many, many reasons. And like we can talk about it more later if I see how you're sitting. Yes?
I'd be interested in having a posture check at some point as yeah. well. I do have back problems, and I usually meditate sitting with my back against the back of the chair, so I try to take your suggestion of sitting forward, and I couldn't sustain it very long. And when I move back and then with the support from the back of the chair, it took a while and my back calmed down, and I was okay again. But I'm a little uncertain whether the pain has to do with problems in my back or just the posture.
Maybe at the end of the class or some end of some other class, I can look at your posture and see. In using a backrest, if you need to use one, if it's possible, it's best then to use have the support as low in your back as possible. So one way is, like these are pretty good chairs, if you get like a towel or a small cushion and put it in your lower back and then wedge yourself back into it really firmly. So you have this really strong support, hard support, really low down. That can actually help propel the upper part. Sorry, upper part of your back is kind of self-supporting or kind of not using a backrest. Mm-hmm. So that can be helpful, and maybe for you. Though some people need to use the whole backrest, and it's fine. Some people will do their meditation actually lying down because that's the only thing that their body will allow them to do. Other questions? Concerns? Anything else that you'd like to ask so far? I talked for a long time. Yes?
You mentioned the tongue touching the roof of the mouth. Any particular part of the tongue? I've read it in some meditations.
The front of the tongue. Tip of the front of the tongue, the tip of the tongue.
Tip of the tongue.
Yeah. So the way that meditation practice unfolds the best is if you do it every day. And the way this kind of five-week introductory course works the best is if you sit every day and take the instructions from each week and do them for that week, and then we'll build on those instructions and as we go along. And I recommend that if you're new to meditation, that you start by sitting 15 minutes a day. And then each week of the five-week course, add 5 minutes to that. So the second week is 20 minutes, the next week is 25. And when you get to 30 minutes, then you can maybe just keep it at 30 if that seems like all you can manage in your busy life, or keep adding 5 minutes until you get to, what would it be, 40 minutes. Most people find it's best to kind of classically to meditate early in the morning. After you wake up. Some people will do it immediately on waking up. Some people will do it after taking a shower and kind of getting all freshened up before eating breakfast. The nice thing about early in the morning is usually it's somewhat quiet around, and you're less likely to have people call you and interrupt you. There's a wonderful, bizarre thing that happens sometimes, especially to beginners in meditation, is they're sitting in meditation, and then you get this overwhelming insight, epiphany, that the refrigerator needs to be defrosted now. It has to be now. And watch for those kinds of thoughts. Just sit there, you know, sit for a lot of time, 15-20 minutes, but some people like to sit at the end of the day and come back from work. Some people like to sit twice a day. It's very nice to sit twice a day, kind of to bracket or punctuate either side of the day with some meditation. It's really, really nice. It's a different kind of meditation, the two different sessions. It's best to do, you kind of arrange things so you're less likely to be disturbed. Maybe unplug the phone if you do it in the afternoon. It's nice, it's very nice to find a place in your house that can be designated the meditation spot. A lot of people, it's in the bedroom because a lot of other things, activities go on there. And so that corner of your house, a little corner of your bedroom, whatever, has association. You know, you have your cushion there and your little place, and you associate that place with meditation. So when you get to that place, you kind of, it's easier because, you know, there's association. It's best to wear loose-fitting clothing when you meditate, especially if you meditate on the floor cross-legged. If your pants are tight, it can constrict your circulation and your feet can go numb. For beginners, often the feet do go numb anyway. Usually within a few weeks or months, the blood will find new routes, and the legs will usually stop falling asleep. Though sometimes they continue for a long time, forever. If your legs fall asleep, maybe it's obvious, but it's very important not to stand up right away. And you kind of massage your foot and get it ready. If your circulation, if your sensation doesn't come back within 4 or 5 minutes, if it takes like 10 minutes for your sensation to come back, then you're not pinching the blood, but you're pinching a nerve. And you never want to do that again. You want to avoid that kind of numbness again, because you don't never want to pinch a nerve or cause that kind of nerve damage. So if it takes more than 5 minutes for your sensation to come back, it's certainly a nerve.
Is it a good idea to use a timer or not?
Timer. I think it's a good idea to use a timer, especially when people are relatively new. And there's different ways of using it. If you use a kitchen timer, it's a little bit jarring. When I was first meditated, I went to a drugstore and got these old-fashioned wind-up clocks that you set the time. I set it for 40 minutes, but I wouldn't turn the alarm on. I just set the alarm arrow to that time. And then when it came around to that time, the clock would click. It wouldn't ring. And then it was a gentle way of... there are other ways, creative ways of timing. One way is say you're going to sit for 20 minutes. You tape record on your cassette tape 20 minutes of silence. And in the 20 minutes of silence, you ring the bell. And then when you're going to meditate, you stick your meditation tape in your machine, turn it on, and you listen to your silence. And then you hear your bell, and you know it's time to... And there are silent timers that make nice sounds you can find. Probably East West Books has meditation timers with wonderful, end of your 20 minutes, you get wonderful sea sounds and crashing sounds and birds twittering. What else?
Bill?
Yes?
You mentioned this idea of distraction. What do you think we're distracting ourselves from?
That's for you to tell me. The reason I say that is that I'm not the expert in anybody's life and anybody's meditation, and it's really the practice is really for me to give you the tools for you to find out for yourself. And it's fascinating to study your life and find out for yourself. And I don't want to take that opportunity away from you. And that question is a very important one. So I encourage you to report back. Yes.
I have a question regarding neck posture. I feel like when I move my neck, sometimes I'll feel more strain. Because I have allergies right now, so I was breathing deeper. I felt it more. So what is the best posture, or is it just because of the allergy, or is it because of the posture that I was feeling more strain?
Could be. I suggested you're tilting the head slightly to make more space back here. But I can imagine that would constrict things a little bit more, and in which case maybe you shouldn't do it. And just find a place, a way for your head to be that is the most relaxed, easy way for you to breathe, and just take that. There's no right way of sitting. All my suggestions were not because of the right way. They're just pragmatically, they're generically kind of the most useful ways to be able to sit for some time, and each of you have to find your own way. Yes.
My experience is I just felt like I wanted to bolt out of here really fast. I guess you just sit there and feel that.
That's right. That's right.
Very uncomfortable.
Well, as we go along, next week I'll talk about the physical experience and how to include it. And the following week I'll talk about emotions. And it'll be a lot easier to know what to do when these things happen, when you've got the instructions for the body and for emotions. But yeah, what you said is right on, just to be there and feel it. And it can be very challenging sometimes to sit still. But what we're learning to do is two things. We're learning to live a life which is not reactive. It's not a slave to all our ways which we feel automatically. And that creates this kind of freedom, a kind of strength to just to not react from our impulses, but rather to act out of choice and responsibility. That's one thing. And the other is we learn about ourselves. And if you bolted in this kind of context, you would have distracted yourself from what was going on, but you don't get that restless unless there's good cause within you. And to really find and to hang out there until you find out what's going on is another good reason to hang in there and learn that ability. I've had that experience, and a lot of people do at various times. So, it's not unusual, and it's quite worthwhile not to bolt. But if you just can't stand it, you're welcome to get up. You know, I wouldn't recommend running over people. But you're welcome to kind of get up, and you can go out and go for a walk, and then fresh air, and come back. Part of what we're developing in mindfulness is this sense of allowing anything that's there to be there, which sometimes is called equanimity in Buddhism. And the challenge is to do that equally for when things are wonderful and for when things are difficult. And many people are quite motivated to discover that wonderful spiritual allowing and equanimity when things are difficult. But as soon as things are wonderful, they don't want to develop equanimity. They love holding on to it. This is great. But we want to have this balance where we allow whatever is to be there as it is. Not to hold on to the joys, not to cling to it, not to expect it, not to manipulate to make it happen, and not to avoid and push away or resist the difficulties that arise, but rather to have this open-handedness or open-heartedness, open-mindedness to whatever might come through you. That's part of what we're learning in mindfulness. And as we learn to have that open-handedness to all experience, our life will be a lot easier. Yes?
So then what do you do when you get thoughts? Are you mindful of them and then do you pay attention to those thoughts or do you go back to breathing?
For now, the instructions is very simple. You just go back to your breathing. Keep it. Right now the instructions are really simple. Just hang out with your breath. You can notice whatever else is happening, kind of note it, be aware of it for a moment. Then gently come back to your breathing. But in the course of the 5 weeks, I'll expand the instructions until you get the full instruction. And you'll know how, it's very simple. The practice is just, like you said, to pay attention to what's happening, pay attention to your thinking. But I don't want to give you the full instruction until you build a foundation to really know how to do that mindfully, clearly. Because if I told you, most of you know, pay attention to your thoughts, you just start thinking more about them. And we're not trying to think about our thoughts, but rather bring the non-discursive attentiveness to them so we don't get involved with them. So the best thing to do is, until we talk about thoughts in the fourth week, don't think in your meditation. don't jump ahead. So let's end with a short sitting. And what I recommend you do is just take 30 seconds to stand and stretch. So take an alert but comfortable posture. Gently close your eyes. And then take a couple of deep breaths, letting go as you breathe out. Letting your breath breathe itself. letting the tactile organ of your body sense and feel the body's experience of breathing from the inside. And ever so softly, you might label breathing in as in, breathing out as out. Letting yourself rest with the inhalations, rest on the exhalations. And it's completely okay for you to be as you are. Just whenever you remember, come back and try to rest as carefully as you can on the rhythm, the cycle of breathing, letting all else fall away. So then again, for the last full minute, let your breathing be the center of your universe, as if it was the most important, wonderful thing in the world, that you're going to devote yourself totally to just this without leaving it. I encourage you to sit every day, and also you might during this week, before the next class, be curious a little bit about the difference attentiveness makes in your everyday life. Just driving to work or doing your shopping or washing the dishes or cooking. Notice if you can see a difference between doing those things with attentiveness, with presence, and the difference that makes, as opposed to doing it preoccupied by other things. Kind of start studying what mindfulness does to your life. So thank you very much, and I hope to see you all next week. And if you want to talk with Allison about some of this paraphernalia, she's available up here. And I'm available for questions if you want to come and talk to me now. Thank you.